Essay on the Ethics of Embryonic Research. The Problem. You were once a single cell. Every one of the 100 trillion cells in your body today is a direct descendant of that zygote, the primordial cell formed by the union of mother's egg and father's sperm. Each one is genetically identical, allowing for copying errors and environmental damage along the way to that cell. Therefore, if we scraped a cell from, say, the inner lining of your cheek, its DNA would be the same DNA that, years ago in the original zygote, contained the entire plan for creating you and every part of you. Here is the mystery. Why can the zygote, as it multiplies, produce every different kind of cell in the body, kidney, liver, brain, skin? While the skin cell is destined, however many times it multiplies, to remain skin forever. As the embryo matures, cells become specialized and lose their flexibility and plasticity. Once an adult cell has specialized, differentiated in scientific lingo, it is stuck forever in that specialty. Skin is skin, kidney is kidney. Understanding that mystery holds the keys to the kingdom. The holy grail of modern biology is regenerative medicine. If we can figure out how to make a specialized adult cell de-differentiate, unspecialize, that is, revert way back to the embryonic stage, perhaps even to the original zygotic stage, and then grow it like an embryo under controlled circumstances, we could reproduce for you every kind of tissue or organ you might need. We could create a storehouse of repair parts for your body, and if we let that de-differentiated cell develop completely in a woman's uterus, we will have created a copy of you, your clone. That is the promise and the menace of cloning. It has already been done in sheep, mice, goats, pigs, cows, and now cats and rabbits, though cloning rabbits seems an exercise in biological redundancy. There is no reason in principle why it cannot be done in humans. The question is, should it be done? Notice that the cloning question is really two questions. One, may we grow that de-differentiated cell all the way into a cloned baby, a copy of you? That is called reproductive cloning. And two, may we grow that de-differentiated cell just into the embryonic stage and then mine it for parts such as stem cells? That is called research cloning. Reproductive cloning is universally abhorred. In July 2001, the House of Representatives, a fairly good representative of the American people, took up the issue, and not a single member defended reproductive cloning. Research cloning, however, is the hard one. Some members were prepared to permit the cloning of the human embryo in order to study and use its component parts, with the proviso that the embryo be destroyed before it grows into a fetus or child. They were a minority, however. Their amendment banning baby-making but permitting research cloning was defeated by 76 votes. On July 31, 2001, a bill outlawing all cloning passed the House decisively. Within weeks, perhaps days, the Senate will vote on essentially the same alternatives. On this vote will hinge the course of the genetic revolution at whose threshold we now stand. The promise. This is how research cloning works. You take a donor egg from a woman, remove its nucleus, and inject the nucleus of, say, a skin cell from another person. It has been shown in animals that by the right manipulation, you can trick the egg and the injected nucleus into de-differentiating. That means giving up all the specialization of the skin cell and returning to its original state as a primordial cell that could become anything in the body. In other words, this cell becomes totipotent. It becomes the equivalent of the fertilized egg in normal procreation, except that instead of having chromosomes from two people, it has chromosomes from one. This cell then behaves precisely like an embryo. It divides. It develops. At 4 to 7 days, it forms a blastocyst, consisting of about 100 to 200 cells. The main objective of research cloning would be to disassemble this blastocyst, pull the stem cells out, grow them in the laboratory, and then try to tease them into becoming specific kinds of cells, say, kidney or heart or brain and so on. There would be two purposes for doing this, study or cure. You could take a cell from a person with a baffling disease like Lou Gehrig's, clone it into a blastocyst, pull the stem cells out, and then study them in order to try to understand the biology of the illness. Or you could begin with a cell from a person with Parkinson's or a spinal cord injury, clone it, and tease out the stem cells to develop tissue that you would re-inject into the original donor to, in theory, cure the Parkinson's or spinal cord injury. The advantage of using a cloned cell rather than an ordinary stem cell is that, presumably, there would be no tissue rejection. It's your own DNA. The body would recognize it. You'd have a perfect match. Research cloning is sometimes called therapeutic cloning, but that is a misleading term. First, because therapy by reinjection is only one of the many uses to which this cloning can be put. Moreover, it is not therapeutic for the clone. Indeed, the clone is invariably destroyed in the process, though it may be therapeutic for others. If you donate a kidney to your brother, it would be odd to call your operation a therapeutic nephrectomy. It is not. It's a sacrificial nephrectomy. The conquest of rejection is one of the principal rationales for research cloning. But there is reason to doubt this claim on scientific grounds. There is some empirical evidence in mice that cloned tissue may be rejected anyway, possibly because a clone contains a small amount of foreign mitochondrial DNA derived from the egg into which it was originally injected. Moreover, enormous advances are being made elsewhere in combating tissue rejection. The science of immune rejection is much more mature than the science of cloning. By the time we figure out how to do safe and reliable research cloning, the rejection problem may well be solved. And finally, there are less problematic alternatives, such as adult stem cells, that offer a promising alternative to cloning because they present no problem of tissue rejection and raise none of cloning's moral conundrums. These scientific considerations raise serious questions about the efficacy of, and thus the need for, research cloning. But there is a stronger case to be made. Even if the scientific objections are swept aside, even if research cloning is as doable and promising as its advocates contend, there are other reasons to pause. The most obvious is this: research cloning is an open door to reproductive cloning. Banning the production of cloned babies while permitting the production of cloned embryos makes no sense. If you have factories all around the country producing embryos for research and commerce, it is inevitable that someone will implant one in a woman, or perhaps in some artificial medium in the farther future, and produce a human clone. What then? A law banning reproductive cloning but permitting research cloning would then make it a crime not to destroy that fetus, an obvious moral absurdity. This is an irrefutable point, and the reason that many in Congress will vote for the total ban on cloning. Philosophically, however, it is a showstopper. It lets us off too early and too easy. It keeps us from facing the deeper question. Is there anything about research cloning that, in and of itself, makes it morally problematic? Objection 1. Intrinsic worth. For some people, life begins at conception, and not just life. If life is understood to mean a biologically functioning organism, even a single cell is obviously alive, but personhood. If the first zygotic cell is owed all the legal and moral respect due a person, then there is nothing to talk about. Ensoulment starts with day one and cell one, and the idea of taking that cell or its successor cells apart to serve someone else's needs is abhorrent. This is an argument of great moral force, but little intellectual interest. Not because it may not be right, but because it is unprovable. It rests on metaphysics. Either you believe it or you don't. The discussion ends there. I happen not to share this view. I do not believe personhood begins at conception. I do not believe a single cell has the moral or legal standing of a child. This is not to say that I do not stand in awe of the developing embryo, a creation of majestic beauty and mystery. But I stand in equal awe of the Grand Canyon, the spider's web, and quantum mechanics. Awe commands wonder, humility, appreciation. It does not command inviolability. I am quite prepared to shatter an atom, take down a spider's web, or dam a canyon for electricity, though we'd have to be very short on electricity before I'd dam the Grand. I do not believe the embryo is entitled to inviolability. But is it entitled to nothing? There is a great distance between inviolability on the one hand and mere thingness on the other. Many advocates of research cloning see nothing but thingness. That view justifies the most ruthless exploitation of the embryo. That view is dangerous. Why? Three possible reasons. First, the Brave New World factor. Research cloning gives man too much power for evil. Second, the slippery slope. The habit of embryonic violation is, in and of itself, dangerous. Violate the blastocyst today and every day, and the practice will inure you to violating the fetus or even the infant tomorrow. Third, manufacture. The very act of creating embryos for the sole purpose of exploiting and then destroying them will ultimately predispose us to a ruthless utilitarianism about human life itself. Objection 2. The Brave New World Factor. The physicists at Los Alamos were not deterred from penetrating, manipulating, and splitting uranium atoms on the grounds that uranium atoms possess intrinsic worth that entitled them to inviolability. Yet after the war, many fought to curtail atomic power. They feared the consequences of delivering such unfathomable power and potential evil into the hands of fallible human beings. Analogously, one could believe that the cloned blastocyst has little more intrinsic worth than the uranium atom and still be deeply troubled by the manipulation of the blastocyst because of the fearsome power it confers upon humankind. The issue is leverage. Our knowledge of how to manipulate human genetics or atomic nuclei is still primitive. We could never construct ex nihilo a human embryo. It is an unfolding organism of unimaginable complexity that took nature 3 billion years to produce. It might take us less time to build it from scratch, but not much less. By that time, we as a species might have acquired enough wisdom to use it wisely. Instead, the human race in its infancy has stumbled upon a genie infinitely too complicated to create or even fully understand, but understandable enough to command and perhaps even control. And given our demonstrated unwisdom with our other great discovery, atomic power, as we speak, the very worst of humanity is on the threshold of acquiring the most powerful weapons in history. This is a fear and a consideration to be taken very seriously. For example, female human eggs seriously limit the mass production of cloned embryos. Extracting eggs from women is difficult, expensive, and potentially dangerous. The search is on, therefore, for a good alternative. Scientists have begun injecting human nuclei into the egg cells of animals. In 1996, Massachusetts scientists injected a human nucleus with a cow egg. Chinese scientists have fused a human fibroblast with a rabbit egg and have grown the resulting embryo to the blastocyst stage. We have no idea what grotesque results might come from such interspecies clonal experiments. In October 2000, the first primate containing genes from another species was born, a monkey with a jellyfish gene. In 1995, researchers in Texas produced headless mice. In 1997, researchers in Britain produced headless tadpoles. In theory, headlessness might be useful for organ transplantation. One can envision, in a world in which embryos are routinely manufactured, the production of headless clones, subhuman creatures with usable human organs but no head, no brain, no consciousness to identify them with the human family. The heart of the problem is this. Nature, through endless evolution, has produced cells with totipotent power. We are about to harness that power for crude human purposes. That should give us pause. Just around the corner lies the logical byproduct of such power. Human-animal hybrids, partly developed human bodies for use as parts, and other horrors imagined, Huxley's deltas and epsilons, and as yet unimagined. This is the Brave New World factor. Its grounds for objecting to this research are not about the beginnings of life, but about the ends. Not the origin of these cells, but their destiny. Not where we took these magnificent cells from, but where they are taking us. Objection 3. The slippery slope. The other prudential argument is that once you start tearing apart blastocysts, you get used to tearing apart blastocysts. And whereas now you'd only be doing that at the 7-day stage, when most people would look at this tiny clump of cells on the head of a pin and say it is not inviolable, it is inevitable that some scientist will soon say, "Give me just a few more weeks to work with it, and I could do wonders." That will require quite a technological leap, because the blastocyst will not develop as a human organism unless implanted in the uterus. That means that to go beyond that 7-day stage, you'd have to implant this human embryo either in an animal uterus or in some fully artificial womb. Both possibilities may be remote, but they are real. And then we'll have a scientist saying, Give me just a few more months with this embryo and I'll have actual kidney cells, brain cells, pancreatic cells that I can transplant back into the donor of the clone and cure him. Scientists at Advanced Cell Technology in Massachusetts have already gone past that stage in animals. They have taken cloned cow embryos past the blastocyst stage, taken tissue from the more developed cow fetus, and reimplanted it back into the donor animal. The scientists' plea to do the same in humans will be hard to ignore. Why grow the clone just to the blastocyst stage? Destroy it. Pull out the inner cell mass, grow stem cells out of that, propagate them in the laboratory, and then try chemically or otherwise to tweak them into becoming kidney cells or brain cells or islet cells. This is Rube Goldberg. Why not just allow that beautiful embryonic machine, created by nature and far more sophisticated than our crude techniques, to develop unmolested? Why not let the blastocyst grow into a fetus that possesses the kinds of differentiated tissue that we could then use for curing the donor? Scientifically, this would make sense. Morally, we will have crossed the line between tearing apart a mere clump of cells and tearing apart a recognizable human fetus. And at that point, it would be an even smaller step to begin carving up 7- and 8-month-old fetuses with more perfectly formed organs to alleviate even more pain and suffering among the living. We will, slowly and by increments, have gone from stem cells to embryo farms to factories with fetuses in various stages of development and humanness, hanging, metaphorically, on meat hooks, waiting to be cut open to be used by the already born. We would all be revolted if a living infant or developed fetus were carved up for parts. Should we build a fence around that possibility by prohibiting any research on even the very earliest embryonic clump of cells? Is the only way to avoid the slide never to mount the slippery slope at all? On this question, I am personally agnostic. If I were utterly convinced that we would never cross the 7-day line, then I would have no objection on these grounds to such research on the inner cell mass of a blastocyst. The question is, can we be sure? This is not a question of principle. It is a question of prudence. It is almost a question of psychological probability. No one yet knows the answer. Objection 4. Manufacture. Note that while up to now I have been considering arguments against research cloning, they are all equally applicable to embryonic research done on a normal, that is, non-cloned, embryo. If the question is tearing up the blastocyst, there is no intrinsic moral difference between a two-parented embryo derived from a sperm and an egg and a single-parented embryo derived from a cloned cell. Thus, the various arguments against this research, the intrinsic worth of the embryo, the prudential consideration that we might create monsters, or the prudential consideration that we might become monsters in exploiting post-embryonic forms of human life, fetuses, or even children, are identical to the arguments for and against stem cell research. These arguments are serious enough to banish the insouciance of the scientists who consider anyone questioning their work to be a Luddite. Yet, in my view, insufficient to justify a legal ban on stem cell research, as with stem cells from discarded embryos in fertility clinics. I happen not to believe that either personhood or ensoulment occurs at conception. I think we need to be apprehensive about what evil might arise from the power of stem cell research, but that apprehension alone, while justifying vigilance and regulation, does not justify a ban on the practice. And I believe that given the good that might flow from stem cell research, we should first test the power of law and custom to enforce the 7-day blastocyst line for embryonic exploitation before assuming that such a line could never hold. This is why I support stem cell research using leftover embryos from fertility clinics, and might support research cloning were it not for one other aspect that is unique to it. In research cloning, the embryo is created with the explicit intention of its eventual destruction. That is a given because not to destroy the embryo would be to produce a cloned child. If you are not permitted to grow the embryo into a child, you are obliged at some point to destroy it. Deliberately creating embryos for eventual and certain destruction means the launching of an entire industry of embryo manufacture. It means the routinization, the commercialization, the commodification of the human embryo. The bill that would legalize research cloning essentially sanctions, licenses, and protects the establishment of a most ghoulish enterprise, the creation of nascent human life for the sole purpose of its exploitation and destruction. How is this morally different from simply using discarded embryos from in vitro fertilization, IVF clinics? Some have suggested that it is not, that to oppose research cloning is to oppose IVF and any stem cell research that comes out of IVF. The claim is made that because in IVF there is a high probability of destruction of the embryo, it is morally equivalent to research cloning. But this is plainly not so. In research cloning, there is not a high probability of destruction. There is 100% probability. Because every cloned embryo must be destroyed, it is nothing more than a means to someone else's end. In IVF, the probability of destruction may be high, but it need not necessarily be. You could have a clinic that produces only a small number of embryos, and we know of many cases of multiple births resulting from multiple embryo implantation. In principle, one could have IVF using only a single embryo, and thus involving no deliberate embryo destruction at all. In principle, that is impossible in research cloning. Furthermore, a cloned embryo is created to be destroyed and used by others. An IVF embryo is created to develop into a child. One cannot disregard intent in determining morality. Embryos are created in IVF to serve reproduction. Embryos are created in research cloning to serve, well, research. If certain IVF embryos were designated as helper embryos that would simply aid an anointed embryo in turning into a child, then we would have an analogy to cloning. But in fact, we don't know which embryo is anointed in IVF. They are all created to have a chance of survival, and they are all equally considered an end. Critics counter that this ends and means argument is really obfuscation, that both procedures make an instrument of the embryo. In cloning, the creation and destruction of the embryo is a means to understanding or curing disease. In IVF, the creation of the embryo is a means of satisfying a couple's need for a child. They are both just means to ends. But it makes no sense to call an embryo a means to the creation of a child. The creation of a child is the destiny of an embryo. To speak of an embryo as a means to creating a child empties the word means of content. The embryo in IVF is a stage in the development of a child. It is no more a means than a teenager is a means to the adult he or she later becomes. In contrast, an embryo in research cloning is pure means, laboratory pure. And that is where we must draw the line. During the great debate on stem cell research, a rather broad consensus was reached among those not committed to intrinsic worth, rendering all embryos inviolable, that stem cell research could be morally justified because the embryos destroyed for their possibly curative stem cells were derived from fertility clinics and thus were going to be discarded anyway. It was understood that human embryos should not be created solely for the purpose of being dismembered and then destroyed for the benefit of others. Indeed, when Senator Bill Frist made his impassioned presentation on the floor of the Senate supporting stem cell research, he included among his conditions a total ban on creating human embryos just to be stem cell farms. Where cloning for research takes us decisively beyond stem cell research is in sanctioning the manufacture of the human embryo. You can try to regulate embryonic research to prohibit the creation of Brave New World monsters. You can build fences on the slippery slope, regulating how many days you may grow an embryo for research. But once you countenance the very creation of human embryos for no other purpose than for their parts, you have crossed a moral frontier. Research cloning is the ultimate in conferring thingness upon the human embryo. It is the ultimate in desensitization, and as such, it threatens whatever other fences and safeguards we might erect around embryonic research. The problem, one could almost say, is not what cloning does to the embryo, but what it does to us. Except that once cloning has changed us, it will inevitably enable further assaults on human dignity. Creating a human embryo just so it can be used and then destroyed undermines the very foundation of the moral prudence that informs the entire enterprise of genetic research. The idea that while a human embryo may not be a person, it is not nothing. Because if it is nothing, then everything is permitted. And if everything is permitted, then there are no fences, no safeguards, no bottom. The New Republic, April 29, 2002, adapted from the author's essay published in Human Cloning and Human Dignity, An Ethical Inquiry, a report of the President's Council on Bioethics, Washington, D.C., July 2002. Chapter 10, Man and God. The Real Message of Creationism. When the Kansas Board of Education voted recently to eliminate evolution from the state science curriculum, the sophisticates had quite a yuck. One editorial cartoon had an ape reclining in a tree telling his mate, "We are descended from the Kansas School Board." The decision has been widely derided as a sign of resurgent Middle American obscuritanism, a throwback to the Scopes monkey trial. Well, to begin with, the Scopes trial is not the great fable the rather fictional Inherit the Wind made it out to be. The instigators of the trial were not blue-nosed know-nothings wanting to persecute some poor teacher for teaching evolution. They were officials of the American Civil Liberties Union, so eager for a test case to overturn a new Tennessee law prohibiting the teaching of evolution that they promised to pay the expenses of the prosecution. The ACLU advertised for a volunteer and found one John Scopes, football coach and science teacher, willing to take the rap. He later said he was not sure whether he'd ever even taught any evolution. Son of Scopes is not quite what it seems either. The twist in the modern saga is the injection of creationism as the scientific alternative to evolution. So, let's be plain. Creationism, which presents Genesis as literally and historically true, is not science. It is faith crudely disguised as science. It is not science because it violates the central scientific canon that a theory must, at least in principle, be disprovable. Creationism is not. Any evidence that might be brought, fossil, geological, astronomical, to contradict the idea that the universe is no more than 6,000 years old, is simply explained away as false clues deliberately created by God at the very beginning. Why? To test our faith? To make fools of modern science? This is hardly even good religion. God may be mysterious, but he is certainly not malicious. And who but a malicious deity would have peppered the universe with endless phony artifacts designed to confound human reason? Creationism has no part in the science curriculum of any serious country. Still, I see no reason why biblical creation could not be taught in the schools, not as science, of course, but for its mythic grandeur and moral dimensions. If we can assign the Iliad and the Odyssey, we certainly ought to be able to assign Genesis. But can we? There's the rub. It is very risky to assign Genesis today. The ACLU might sue. Ever since the Supreme Court decision of 1963 barring prayer from the public schools, any attempt to import not just prayer, but biblical studies, religious tenets, and the like into the schools is liable to end up in court. That is why the Kansas School Board decision on evolution is so significant. Not because Kansas is the beginning of a creationist wave. As science, creationism is too fundamentally frivolous and evolution too intellectually powerful. But because the Kansas decision is an important cultural indicator. It represents the reaction of people of faith to the fact that all legitimate expressions of that faith in their children's public schooling are blocked by the new secular ethos. In a society in which it is unconstitutional to post the Ten Commandments in school, creationism is a backdoor to religion, brought in under the guise, the absurd yet constitutionally permitted guise, of science. This pedagogic sleight of hand, by the way, did not originate with religious folk. Secularists have for years been using biology instruction as a backdoor for inculcating their values. A sex ed class on the proper placement of a condom is more than instruction in reproductive mechanics. It is a seminar, unacknowledged and tacit but nonetheless powerful, on permissible sexual mores. Religion, invaluable in America's founding, forming, and flowering, deserves a place in the schools. Indeed, it had that place for almost 200 years. A healthy country would teach its children evolution and the Ten Commandments. The reason that Kansas is going to have precisely the opposite, the worst of both worlds, is not because Kansans are primitives, but because a religious people has tried to bring the fruits of faith, the teachings and higher values of religion, into the schools and been stymied. The result is a kind of perverse, Law of conservation of faith. Block all teaching of religious ideas? Okay, we'll sneak them in through biology. This is nutty. It has kids looking for God in all the wrong places. For the purposes of a pluralist society, the Bible is not about fact. It is about values. If we were a bit more tolerant about allowing the teaching of biblical values as ethics, we'd find far less pressure for the teaching of biblical fables as science. Time, November 22nd, 1999. God versus Caesar. In 1857, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney handed down the Dred Scott decision upholding and extending slavery. Taney's opinion was, it is generally agreed, the worst constitutional decision of the 19th century. The words are Robert Bork's. Yet, there is a curious and little-known fact about Judge Taney. More than 30 years earlier, he had freed his own slaves. Today, therefore, we would say that while he was personally opposed to slavery, he did not want to impose his views on others. The Taney contradiction, privately opposed to but publicly tolerant of some widespread social practice, is the preferred position on abortion of pro-choice Catholic politicians today. This view does not sit well with the Catholic Church. It holds, quite plausibly, that the Taney position is as morally incoherent when applied to abortion as it was when applied to slavery. At the center of the debate is New York Governor Mario Cuomo, who personally believes that abortion is sinful, but as governor has supported no abortion restrictions, indeed has advocated state funding of abortions for poor women. For this, one New York bishop has said that Cuomo is in danger of losing his soul and going to hell. Another New York bishop barred Cuomo from any church function in his diocese, later modified as a ban on discussing abortion at any church function. Cardinal John O'Connor of New York has backed up his two bishops, continuing the argument he started with Cuomo in 1984 about whether it is possible to have it both ways, Taney-like, on abortion. Liberal commentary has rushed into the breach to argue not so much the merits of the issue but the propriety of the bishops getting involved in the first place. The claim is that these clerical admonitions constitute an assault on the separation of church and state, a denial of religious pluralism, a form of religious tyranny. These prelates, writes Arthur Schlesinger, seem to be doing their best to verify the fears long cherished by a succession of anti-Catholic demagogues that the Roman Catholic Church would try to overrule the American democratic process. This idea of overruling is outright nonsense. The Catholic Church is in no way compelling anyone to do anything, let alone interdicting the will of the majority. If it does manage to persuade a majority of Americans that abortion is wrong and ought to be banned, how is that different from any other group persuading a Democratic majority to ban, say, polygamy or drug taking? As for the threats to Cuomo, they are entirely self-imposed. The force of the bishop's moral appeal derives exclusively from Cuomo's own freely offered profession that, I am a governor, I am a Democrat, but I am a Catholic first. My soul is more important to me than my body. Unlike President Kennedy, Cuomo is more than a nominal Catholic. His profession of faith makes him subject voluntarily to the teachings of his church. For the church to which he voluntarily adheres to repeat to him its position on abortion, as well as the penalties the church believes are due those who violate it, is hardly an act of imposition. It is an act of religious teaching that Cuomo himself invites when he says, I and many others like me are eager for enlightenment, eager to learn new and better ways to manifest respect for the deep reverence for life that is our religion and our instinct. The other liberal complaint is that since the Catholic position on abortion is religiously derived, if it ultimately becomes law, that constitutes an imposition of religion. This argument is nonsense, too. Under American concepts of political pluralism, it makes no difference from where a belief comes. Whether it comes from church teaching, inner conviction, or some trash novel, the legitimacy of any belief rests ultimately on its content, not on its origin. It is absurd to hold that a pro-abortion position derived from, say, Paul Ehrlich's overpopulation doomsday scenario is legitimate, but an anti-abortion position derived from Scripture is a violation of the First Amendment. The provenance of an opinion has nothing to do with its legitimacy as a contender for public opinion and as candidate for becoming public law. Moreover, it is particularly hypocritical for liberals to profess outrage at the involvement of the Catholic Church in this political issue, when only a few decades ago, much of the civil rights and anti-war movements was run out of the churches. When Martin Luther King Jr. invoked Scripture in support of his vision of racial equality, and when the American Catholic bishops invoked Augustine in their pastoral letter opposing nuclear deterrence, not a liberal in the land protested that this constituted a violation of the separation of church and state. To his credit, Cuomo does not join the liberal chorus in denying the prelates a right to speak as they wish on abortion. Not so for many of his backers. When it suits their political purposes, they approve, they demand that the church stand up for right. When it does not suit them, Schlesinger comes forward to warn darkly that such outspokenness risks stirring up anti-Catholic bigotry. On the face of it, I would say that it already has. The Washington Post, March 23, 1990. Body worship. For a long time, from the counterculture of the 1960s until, well, yesterday, it was pretty easy to tell conservatives from liberals. Conservatives were the folks who told you how to live your personal life. Liberals were the ones who told government and everybody else to lay off and leave you to your own space. Conservatives went around promoting virtue and regulating vice, pornography, drugs, illegitimacy, and the like. Liberals stood for self-expression and autonomy. The right to choose is quintessentially liberal, whether it be abortion or euthanasia or, as they say today, whatever. Then came tobacco. Liberals who had developed a 39-year reputation for being soft on drugs and crime and polymorphous perversities that even Freud could not have imagined, all of a sudden became caped crusaders. When it comes to smoking, they are blue-nose prohibitionists. True, the anti-smoking campaign has broad support, but liberal Democrats have labored mightily to make it their cause. It began with the famous hearings chaired by the preeminent California liberal, Henry Waxman, at which tobacco executives were made to line up and swear that nicotine is not addictive. Its apotheosis was Al Gore's 1996 convention speech, with its lachrymose retelling of his sister's death and his solemn pledge, "Until I draw my last breath, to pour my heart and soul into carrying on the anti-smoking fight." War on tobacco would be the liberals' cause. This seems odd. Liberals have always looked down their noses at any kind of prohibition, whether it was alcohol in the 20s or abortion today. They're for choice, are they not? But as smokers are chased out of their offices and banished from polite society, what little pro-smoking resistance there is comes from the right, from libertarians, from free market conservatives, and from traditionalists lamenting the state's forced extirpation of a venerable and private habit. So what happened to liberals? My theory is this. Liberals have watched, astonished, as for decades, conservatives thrived politically by showing concern for individual behavior. After years of deriding conservative moralizing, liberals now are playing catch-up. Hence, for example, their slavish, often comical, adoption of the language of family values. Conservatives have made a political career out of showing concern for the soul. Liberals cannot quite bring themselves to support state regulation of the soul. Indeed, by family values, they mean not sexual morality, but subsidized child care and a living wage. So they have come up with their own alternative, not care for the soul, but care for the body. Health is their religion, the body their temple. Laissez-faire? No concern about right behavior? Not us, say the liberals. We too believe in virtue. No smoking, and that's just for starters. We are going to teach your kids safe sex, take Alar off their apples, feed them yogurt and broccoli for lunch, and for the ride home, lash them to their safety seats in cars with mandatory airbags. Who says we don't care? Our motto, a healthy multicultural mind and a healthy body. Call it pagan if you like, we call it prudent. Now, if you have any doubts about the liberals' newfound religion, take in a sex education class at your kid's school. The hour is not devoted to biblical, Victorian, traditional morality. Sure, the kids are taught do's and don'ts. It's just that the don'ts are not actions that damn your eternal soul, but behaviors that doom your precious body. The core of the modern sexual code is disease prevention. The reason your little ones are taught the proper placement of a condom over a banana is to protect them from sexually transmitted diseases. With AIDS as a foil, Sex ed is not a form of moral education. It is a branch of hygiene, as are the other liberal virtues like the mania for health foods. It feeds a nutritional fanaticism and fastidiousness that make Islamic and Jewish dietary prohibitions look positively, well, liberal. In elite society, thinness is not just attractive, but virtuous, a sign of self-denial and strength of character. Fatness is not just unaesthetic, it is a moral failing. Temptation no longer comes in the form of the devil, it comes in the form of dessert. This cult of the body is the perfect successor to the culture of narcissism of the me generation. Its genius is to take the stigma out of self-love and turn it into virtue. Its beauty is to take health and hygiene, perfectly good things, mind you, and make them a religion. In a political era demanding more public displays of piety and morality, liberals can now enthusiastically declare, "We got religion too." The Washington Post, September 26, 1997. Chernenko and the Case Against Atheism. There have been many arguments made against atheism. The medieval philosophers divined a variety of proofs of God's existence. Aquinas had five. But the argument from motion or the argument from contingency is not the kind of thing we moderns talk about anymore. So for the definitive modern case against atheism, I suggest a radically modern experience. Watch a Soviet funeral. I do it all the time. As Soviet state funerals have become regular events, Chernenko's was the third revival in 28 months of Death of a Helmsman. I become a regular viewer. They mesmerize me in a horrible sort of way. It's not just the music, the numbing repetition of Chopin's funeral march, but the massive, stone-cold setting. The Lenin Mausoleum, the focus of the ceremonies, is a model of socialist, brutalist architecture. Cathedrals also remind us of the smallness of man, but poignantly, by comparing him to God. The Lenin Mausoleum has nothing to compare man to but its own squat vastness. The comparison is mocking. Then there are the speeches, a jangle of empty phrases. Chernenko was eulogized for his links to the masses, his party principledness, his achievements in the fields of ideology and propaganda. Was there a man behind, underneath all this socialist realism? If so, not a word about him. The utter effacement of the person by the party reminded me of a response spokesman Vladimir Posner gave a few weeks ago to an American's question about Chernenko's health. "In this country," he said, annoyed, "the private lives of the leadership are not subject to discussion." It was as if he had been asked to confirm Chernenko's sexual preferences, not his existence. Finally, and to me most chilling, was the open casket displaying Chernenko's and Andropov's and Brezhnev's powdered body drowning in a sea of fresh flowers. The open bier is a mere variation on a communist theme, the mummification of the great leader. In believing cultures where there is some sense of a surviving soul, this pathetic attachment to the body is unnecessary. In fact, it is discouraged. In the great monotheistic religions, the Redeemer, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, has no earthly resting place at all. In the great materialist religions, Soviet and Chinese communism, the resting place of the Redeemer, indeed his frozen body, becomes a shrine. The result is the ultimate grotesquerie, after death, a fantastic assertion of the final primacy of man, even after he has become nothing more than embalmer's clay. It turns out, I'm not the only one to have been chilled by the barrenness of the Soviet way of death. Shortly after his return from Brezhnev's funeral, Vice President George Bush talked about what had struck him the most. He mentioned the austere pageantry, the goose-stepping soldiers, the music, the body being drawn through Red Square, not incidentally by horses, but behind an armored personnel carrier. But what struck me most was the fact that from start to finish, there was not one mention of God. Why should that matter, you ask? After all, many of us are as tepid in our belief as the proverbial Unitarian who believes that there is, at most, one God. What is wrong with a society that believes in none? The usual answer follows the lines of an observation by Arthur Schlesinger and others, that the declining faith in the supernatural has been accompanied by the rise of the monstrous totalitarian creeds of the 20th century. or as Chesterton put it, the trouble when people stop believing in God is not that they thereafter believe in nothing, it is that they thereafter believe in anything. In this century, anything has included Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, authors of the great genocidal madnesses of our time. However, as the robotic orderliness of Chernenko's funeral demonstrates, the Soviet system is now anything but mad. The monstrous creeds have changed. Totalitarianism was once a truly crusading faith, messianic, hopeful, mobilized, and marching. Now it is dead, burnt out. Classical totalitarianism has been replaced by what philosopher Michael Walzer calls failed totalitarianism, the cold, empty shell of the old madness. The zeal, the energy, the purpose are gone. Only bureaucracy and cynicism remain. Today, the Soviet system, the greatest of all the failed totalitarianisms, no longer believes in anything. It now believes in nothing. A nothing on eerie display at Wednesday's funeral. Chesterton's case against atheism is that even if it is, God forbid, true, it is dangerous. 3 hours of watching Chernenko placed in the Kremlin wall convinces me otherwise. The case against a public life bereft of all spirituality rests less on its danger than on its utter desolation. The Washington Post, March 15, 1985. Chapter 11. Memory and Monuments. Sweet Land of Liberty. Uniquely among the capitals of the world, Washington's monumental core pays homage to the word. The glory of the Jefferson Memorial is not the founder's statue, but carved in stone around him, his words on religious freedom, inalienable rights, and sacred honor. At the Lincoln Memorial, one cannot but be moved by the eyes and grave bearing of the martyred president. But even more moving are the surrounding words, the sublime cadences of the second inaugural and the Gettysburg Address, both in their entirety. Lincoln's gift for concision helps. Castro of the 8-hour speeches could not be so memorialized. Other capitals celebrate the gloria and fortuna of victory. No arch of triumph here. True, in the last few decades, the mall has added Vietnam and Korean memorials. But these are hardly glorifications of battle. They are melancholy meditations upon wars of sorrow. The very newest addition, the World War II Memorial, is jarring and deeply out of place precisely because its massive and pointless wreath-bearing Teutonic columns represent European triumphalism, disfiguring the heart of a mall heretofore dedicated to the power and glory of ideas. But Washington has a second distinction, more subtle and even more telling about the nature of America. Its many public statues to foreign liberators. I'm not talking about the statues of Churchill and Lafayette, great allies and participants in America's own epic struggles against tyranny. Everybody celebrates friends. I'm talking about the liberators who had nothing to do with us. Walk a couple of blocks from DuPont Circle at the heart of commercial Washington, and you come upon a tiny plaza graced by Gandhi with walking stick. And perhaps 100 yards from him, within shouting distance, stands Tomas Masaryk, the great Czech patriot and statesman. Masaryk, in formal dress and aristocratic demeanor, has nothing in common with the robed, slightly bent Gandhi with whom he shares the street, except that they were both great liberators, and except that they are honored by Americans precisely for their devotion to freedom. Farther up the avenue stands Robert Emmet, the Irish revolutionary, while one block to the west of Masaryk looms a massive monument to a Ukrainian poet and patriot, Taras Shevchenko. And then, gracing the avenues near the mall, are the Americans, great statues to Central and South American liberators, not just Juarez and Bolivar, but even the more obscure, such as General José Artigas, father of modern Uruguay. Discount, if you will, as fashionable anti-Americanism does, the Statue of Liberty as ostentatious self-advertising, or perhaps a relic of an earlier, more pure America. But as you walk the streets of Washington, it is harder to discount America's quiet homage to foreign liberators, statues built decades apart, without self-consciousness and without any larger architectural, let alone political, plan. They have but one thing in common. They share America's devotion to liberty. Liberty not just here, but everywhere. Indeed, liberty for its own sake. America has long proclaimed this principle, but in the post-9/11 era, it has pursued it with unusual zeal and determination. Much of the world hears America declare the spread of freedom, the centerpiece of its foreign policy, and insists nonetheless that America's costly sacrifices in Iraq and even Afghanistan are nothing more than classic imperialism in search of dominion, oil, pipelines, or whatever such commodity most devalues America's exertions. The overwhelming majority of Americans refuse to believe that. Whatever their misgivings about the cost and wisdom of these wars, they know how deep and authentic is the American devotion to liberty. Many around the world find such sentiments and the accompanying declarations hard to credit. Europeans, in particular, with their long tradition of realpolitik, cannot conceive of a great power actually believing such hopeless idealism. The skepticism is misplaced. It is not just that brave American soldiers die to permit Iraqis and Afghans to vote for the first time in their lives. There is evidence closer to home and of older pedigree. The skeptics might take a stroll through America's other great capital, up New York's 6th Avenue with its series of 7 sculptures to Latin American leaders, culminating at Central Park with magnificent statues of Bolivar, Martí, and San Martín. To Washington Square Park, where they will find the Italian revolutionary Garibaldi, while his more Republican counterpart, Mazzini, resides along West Drive, not very far from Lajos Kossuth, now of Riverside Drive, hero of the Hungarian Revolution of 1848. This is not for show. It is from the heart of a people conceived in liberty and still believing in liberty. How can they not? It is written in stone all around them. The Washington Post, November 25, 2005. Holocaust Museum. I have long been uneasy about the idea of a Holocaust museum in Washington. If there is to be a showcase of the Jewish experience in the heart of America, why must it be the Holocaust? Why should Jews, a people with such an epic tradition, present themselves to America solely as victims of the greatest crime in history? The Jew as victim. Is this really what we want the visitor from Montana, who may not have met a Jew in his life, to carry home with him? It was with these reservations that I visited the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum that was dedicated yesterday in Washington. The museum changed my mind. Beginning with James Fried's severe, demanding building, it is a masterpiece. In the East Building of the National Gallery, the absence of right angles is a pleasant geometrical conceit. In the Holocaust Museum, the acute, unforgiving angles, the sharp, forced turns, are a powerful pedagogical device. This is the architecture of forced marches, of mechanized cruelty, of industrialized death. The building's texture of raw steel and brick and granite gives the feel of a factory. But its calculated irrationalities, cracked lines, dead ends, blotted windows, narrowing staircases, imply a machinery of derangement. The details of that derangement are the subject of the permanent exhibit, 3 harrowing floors that take you step by step from the rise of Hitler in 1933 through the destruction of European Jewry 12 years later. Long before you reach the ovens of Majdanek, the shoes of Auschwitz, you feel you have had enough. But there is no escape until the liberation at the end of the 3 floors and the emergence into a hall of remembrance, a stark, skylit hexagon, a chamber of reflection after a journey through absolute evil. I know more about the Holocaust than I want to. Here, I learned even more. I had, for example, made errors of scale. The cattle cars packed with Jews headed for death. You walk through one that took the doomed to Treblinka, were much smaller than I had imagined, the gas chambers of Auschwitz. A huge diorama depicts the actual machinery of scientific mass murder were much larger. These were not rooms of death. These were auditoria of death. They took hundreds, thousands at a time for asphyxiation. I had imagined dozens. Yet one of the triumphs of the museum is that it rises above numbers. It contains, for example, a 3-story tower of photographs, taken over a half century by the Jewish inhabitants of the village of Ishishki. Pictures of ordinary, flourishing life, a jaunty skater, a naughty smoker, bathers, lovers, mothers, cantors. These are the faces of the Jews of Eshishki, 3500 in 1939. A brief notation nearly buried in the wall text informs the visitor what he had feared upon entering this gallery of vibrant life. That in 2 days, September 25th and 26th, 1941, the Nazis and their Lithuanian collaborators herded and shot the Jews of Eshishki, leaving it forever Judenrein. We return to the perennial problem of Holocaust remembrance, presenting Jews as victims. Does the Holocaust Museum solve it? No, but with the success, if one is permitted to use such a word in such a context, of the museum, its fidelity, its subtlety, its power, the problem loses its urgency. Yes, dwelling on the Holocaust has its price, but a museum so miraculously executed is worth the price. Yes, the Holocaust is but one part of the Jewish experience, but it is a monumental part and perishable. As this generation passes, the memory of the Holocaust will fade. This museum, immovable, irrefutable, will do much to guard the memory. And it will do so not just by what it says and how well it says it, but where it says it. The Hall of Remembrance has at each of its six corners a narrow vertical window. Through one, you can see the Washington Monument. Through another, the Jefferson Memorial. The juxtaposition is not just redemptive, it is reassuring. The angels of democracy stand watch on this temple of evil. It is as if only in the heart of the world's most tolerant and most powerful democracy can such terrible testimony be safely contained. Only here will it remain secure and unmolested for the instruction of future generations. Hitler boasted that his Reich would last 1,000 years. One has the feeling that in this building it will. One has the feeling that here the film, taken by the Nazis themselves, of the machine gunning of the innocents of one Jewish town, will run night and day until the end of time. Here in such a building, in such a place, infamy will achieve the immortality to which it aspired. Yes, there are Holocaust memorials in Poland and elsewhere, but these are not to be trusted. Who knows what Europe, birthplace of the Nazi plague, will one day say of or do with these monuments? There were anti-Jewish pogroms in Poland right after World War II, as if Hitler's job needed finishing. Yes, there is a memorial in Israel. One might say that Israel itself is a memorial to the Holocaust. But there will be those in generations to come who will not trust the testimony of Jews. With this building, America bears witness. The liberators have returned to finish the job. First rescue, then remembrance. Bless them. The Washington Post, April 23, 1993. Sacrilege at Ground Zero. A place is made sacred by a widespread belief that it was visited by the miraculous or the transcendent. Lourdes, the Temple Mount, by the presence there once of great nobility and sacrifice, Gettysburg, or by the blood of martyrs and the indescribable suffering of the innocent, Auschwitz. When we speak of Ground Zero as hallowed ground, what we mean is that it belongs to those who suffered and died there, and that such ownership obliges us, the living, to preserve the dignity and memory of the place, never allowing it to be forgotten, trivialized, or misappropriated. That's why Disney's 1993 proposal to build an American history theme park near Manassas Battlefield was defeated by a broad coalition that feared vulgarization of the Civil War, and that was wiser than me. At the time, I obtusely saw little harm in the venture. It's why the commercial viewing tower built right on the border of Gettysburg was taken down by the Park Service. It's why, while no one objects to Japanese cultural centers, the idea of putting one up at Pearl Harbor would be offensive. And why Pope John Paul II ordered the Carmelite nuns to leave the convent they had established at Auschwitz. He was in no way devaluing their heartfelt mission to pray for the souls of the dead. He was teaching them a lesson in respect. This is not your place, it belongs to others. However pure your voice, better to let silence reign. Even New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who denounced opponents of the proposed 15-story mosque and Islamic Center near Ground Zero as tramplers on religious freedom, asked the mosque organizers to show some special sensitivity to the situation. Yet, as columnist Rich Lowry pointedly noted, the government has no business telling churches how to conduct their business, shape their message, or show special sensitivity to anyone about anything. Bloomberg was thereby inadvertently conceding the claim of those he excoriates for opposing the mosque, namely that Ground Zero is indeed unlike any other place, and therefore unique criteria govern what can be done there. Bloomberg's implication is clear. If the proposed mosque were controlled by insensitive Islamist radicals either excusing or celebrating 9/11, he would not support its construction. But then, why not? By the mayor's own expansive view of religious freedom, by what right do we dictate the message of any mosque? Moreover, as a practical matter, there's no guarantee that this couldn't happen in the future. Religious institutions in this country are autonomous. Who's to say that the mosque won't one day hire an Anwar al-Awlaki, spiritual mentor to the Fort Hood shooter and the Christmas Day bomber, and one-time imam at the Virginia mosque attended by two of the 9/11 terrorists? An al-Awlaki preaching in Virginia is a security problem. An al-Awlaki preaching at Ground Zero is a sacrilege. Or would the mayor then step in, violating the same First Amendment he grandiosely pretends to protect from mosque opponents, and exercise a veto over the mosque's clergy? Location matters, especially this location. Ground Zero is the site of the greatest mass murder in American history, perpetrated by Muslims of a particular Islamist orthodoxy, in whose cause they died and in whose name they killed. Of course, that strain represents only a minority of Muslims. Islam is no more intrinsically Islamist than present-day Germany is Nazi. Yet, despite contemporary Germany's innocence, no German of goodwill would even think of proposing a German cultural center at, say, Treblinka. Which makes you wonder about the goodwill behind Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf's proposal. This is a man who has called U.S. policy an accessory to the crime of 9/11, and when recently asked whether Hamas is a terrorist organization, replied, "I'm not a politician. The issue of terrorism is a very complex question." America is a free country where you can build whatever you want, but not anywhere. That's why we have zoning laws. No liquor store near a school, no strip malls where they offend local sensibilities, and if your house doesn't meet community architectural codes, you cannot build at all. These restrictions are for reasons of aesthetics. Others are for more profound reasons of common decency and respect for the sacred. No commercial tower over Gettysburg, no convent at Auschwitz, and no mosque at Ground Zero. Build it anywhere, but there. The governor of New York offered to help find land to build the mosque elsewhere. A mosque really seeking to build bridges, Rauf's ostensible hope for the structure, would accept the offer. The Washington Post, August 13, 2010. FDR, The Dignity of Denial. Even as President Clinton officially opened the Franklin Roosevelt Memorial last Friday in Washington, the great controversy raged. The memorial contains no statue of FDR in a wheelchair. Should it? The arguments pro and con are by now well known. One side points out that when a man has over 35,000 photographs taken of him and exactly two show him in a wheelchair, we can fairly conclude that he was intent upon concealing his disability. How odd, then, to honor a man by portraying him precisely opposite to the way he wanted to be seen. The other side argues that Roosevelt was merely reflecting the prejudices of his time. He needed to hide his disability to achieve high office. Had he lived today, he would wear his wheels proudly. However, the whole debate seems to miss the point. The very question of what Roosevelt would have wanted makes no sense. It depends on which Roosevelt. If the real Roosevelt, President of the United States, 1933 to 1945, the answer is obvious. He would not, he did not, want his splendid deception undone. And if by Roosevelt we mean Roosevelt today, that is, a Roosevelt who had absorbed all the self-revelatory cultural conventions of our time, well, then, of course, he would bear everything. He would go on Oprah, indeed, not just in a wheelchair, but hand in hand with Lucy Mercer. The point is not what some imaginary FDR would want, a question both indeterminate and unanswerable. The point is, which of these competing ideals, the restraint and reticence of the historical FDR versus the self-revelation and display of today's politicians that we would impute to a contemporary FDR, do we want to honor in a great national monument? I vote for reticence. The current statue, FDR in his wooden kitchen chair with casters, a great cape hiding the tiny wheels from all but the most observant visitor, captures perfectly Roosevelt's cloaking of his disability. At a time when our politicians are stricken with self-pity and given to sniveling, to quote Mary McGrory, what a balm is Roosevelt's attitude of defiant and dignified denial. This is an age in which both the Speaker of the House and the President of the United States cannot resist in dramatic televised addresses, making pointed reference to their latest bereavement. This is an age in which the Vice President, in consecutive convention speeches, makes lachrymose use, first of a son's accident, then of a sister's death. Noted one mordant wit, at this rate, his wife had better not walk near any plate glass windows. In such an age, we can use the example of a man who, through four presidential terms, dealt with the agony of a nation while keeping his own agonies to himself. In an age in which every celebrity finds it necessary to bare his soul and open her closet, we need a monument to a man who would have disdained such displays. Why, even poor Bob Dole found himself going up and down America for months, talking about how reluctant he was to talk about the war injuries he could not stop talking about. Such is the style of the 90s. Fine. But who dares argue that it can match Roosevelt's for nobility? It is not just that we have no right to impose our sensibility on Roosevelt. We should be ashamed to. Leave Roosevelt out of a wheelchair. But not by saying condescendingly, well, he lived in a benighted time, let's make a concession to the attitudes he had to accommodate. After all, Roosevelt's deception did not reflect the attitudes just of his constituents. It reflected his own attitude to his disability. It is not just that he never discussed his paralysis with the voters. He never discussed it with his mother. The critics say that to fail to portray FDR in a wheelchair is to give in to his false, that is, non-modern, consciousness about disability. On the contrary, it is to celebrate his ethos of bold denial. Denial is not in great favor today. It is considered unhealthy, an almost cowardly psychic constriction. The mantra today is that all must be dealt with, talked out, coped with, opened up, faced squarely. This may work for some, but it has become something of a religion. And if its priests are so correct about the joys of catharsis and the perils of denial, how do they explain how the champion denier of our century, Franklin Roosevelt, lived such a splendid life? Roosevelt's denial of his disability was more than just a denial of crushing adversity, more than a jaunty, smiling, damn-the-torpedoes refusal to dwell upon, indeed fully acknowledge, his physical reality. It was a denial of self, a strange notion for us living in this confessional age when self, self-exploration, self-expression, self-love is paramount. Roosevelt's life had a grand outer directedness. He was not searching for the inner Franklin. He was reaching for a new America. It was the outer Franklin he cultivated, and it is that Franklin, the one who saved his country, that we honor and remember. At a time like ours, when every cultural cue is an incitement to self-revelation, we can use a solitary monument to reticence. Leave FDR as he is. Time, May 12, 1997.